This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
In the recent past, anti-Muslim hate crimes and rhetoric have surged across America and Europe. Much of this public discourse revolves around questions of assimilation and where Muslim positions on sexuality and gender fit into national unity. In Sexagon, Muslims, France, and the Sexualization of National Culture, Mohammed Amadeus Mack explores the politicization of Muslim minority sexuality in France in various cultural domains. Whether in literature, journalistic media, or activist endeavors, the general portrayal of Muslims in these contexts is structured around unmodern attitudes towards sexuality. It is assumed that African and Arab minorities in France are regressive, patriarchal, and intolerant of homosexuality. Through his study of a number of cultural arenas of representation, Mack demonstrates that sexual identities are often unclear, hidden, or in flux. In our conversation, we discuss sexuality and French identity, aspects of non-gendered virility, homosexual clandestinity and the possibility of queer identities, girl gangs, psychoanalysis and Islam, the literary trope of the Arab boy, cinematic representations of ethnic sexualities, the management and surveillance of sexuality, the role of pornography in the sexualization of Muslims, gay interest publications, the continued sexual demonization of Muslims in the current social climate in France and Europe, and the literary production of Eurabia. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Mohammed Amadeus Mack about his wonderful new book, Sexagon, Muslims, France, and the Sexualization of National Culture, published with Fordham University Press in 2017. Welcome, Mohammed. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Islamic Studies. How are you?
Great. Happy to be here.
Now, your book, Sexagon, this is really an excellent book. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's theoretically rich, really challenges the reader in new ways, both in kind of how you're approaching your content, but also kind of the various types of texts, so to speak, you're looking at. So it's a fascinating book, and eager to talk to you about it. We always start a little bit about the authors themselves. So can you tell us a little bit about
What brought you to the study of Muslim societies, to France, people that might have been influential in steering you into certain types of approaches or content that you're interested in? What made you the scholar you are today?
So first, I want to say thanks for inviting me to do this. I rarely get to sort of speak about my work in this kind of interactive format. So I'll start kind of the story with my high school experience. So I grew up in Southern California, and I'm the child of two immigrants, basically, one from Austria, the other from the Arab world. And I'm not going to say where, just out of privacy. But basically, I was in a French school, Le Lycée Français de Los Angeles, which is kind of this private school. And I met a lot of North African students there. And what was kind of interesting for me was that I was able to sort of access Arab culture, Muslim culture from an alternative route, in a sense, because I didn't grow up speaking Arabic, or barely. I was taught a little bit by my grandmother and spent a little time in the Middle East. But really, I was learning French before Arabic. So French was always sort of like the intellectual language for me, the language that I thought in and studied in, and that I would do, you know, if I was ever to do something interesting in terms of research in college, it would be in French. So that kind of got me interested in the Arab diaspora in Europe. And I also realized that, like, even though there might be a lot of Arab Americans in the United States, we're kind of atomized, and we don't really constitute a visible community in the same way that North Africans and Arabs do in France. And so it was sort of like, studying the North African experience in France was for me a way to sort of be part of a community in a way that I couldn't in the United States, or at least consider a community. Partly because, you know, there's so much positive association around the word community in the United States. And that's something that I constantly actually revisit in my teaching, is the idea of community being something positive or something negative when it comes to sort of communitarism or communitarianism in France, or people who like that associates with like. And then I would say, fast forwarding to the college years, I kind of dropped French for a while, and I came back to this topic for an English honors thesis that I wrote about literary tourism in North Africa, and in particular, literary tourism that had a sexual or romantic dimension. And so I was getting into the work of André Gide in the American pronunciation, and other Europeans who went to North Africa and kind of had experiences of personal transformation or discovery, and especially sexual discovery. And so I was kind of interested in that, and I used that writing sample in order to get into grad school at Columbia University, this time in a French and comparative literature department. And then it became time to sort of pick a topic to study. And initially, I wanted to just study kind of alternative sexuality and the Arab diaspora in France. And my advisors kind of encouraged me to have a broader scope and to make the topic more relevant. And so what I did was sort of, instead of considering something like homosexuality, I switched my focus to homophobia, for instance, and the politicization of homophobia. Because everyone is touched by homophobia. Everyone has an attitude about homosexuality and homophobia in a way that, you know, is different from the narrowness of homosexual experience. So it kind of affects more people. And I was encouraged to sort of do something with a more universal scope. So then I kind of got into the topic of like sexual demonization, or how certain minorities or immigrant groups are basically demonized in the media as sexual menaces or threats. and how that relates to more traditional forms of xenophobia and far right and even just right wing politics. Then I got kind of interested in, so there's already been work done in that, in kind of that vein by people like Nassira Guenif Soleimas or Eric Fassin or Maxime Servul and Nick Rhys Roberts. These are kinds of, these are the books that, that really have dealt with this topic. But my intervention was to do it more in terms of like cultural studies and to study sort of the contemporary moment also. And to study how the cultural arena actually participates in that politicization of sexuality and the demonization of minorities and immigrants. So, you know, one of the premises of sort of the work I'm doing is that sexuality today is politicized, and the way it's politicized is that people's integration is, or immigrants' integration and their descendants is being judged according to the fitness of their views on sexuality and having sort of a quote unquote progressive set of views on sexuality, with progressive just being sort of the attitudes they are assumed not to have, right? So they're assumed to be homophobic, they're assumed to be sexually intolerant. And a part of the task of a part of my task here was to first sort of criticize that very kind of recent amalgamation between proper citizenship and proper quote unquote attitudes about sexuality, but also to kind of dispel this idea that Muslims, Arabs in France are never queer or do not experience alternative sexuality or do not have aspects of their own cultures that have a place for, you know, homoeroticism or gender experimentation or even just the parts of Arab and Islamic cultures that might be judged as queer or alternative in terms of their gender expression. I was kind of trying to emphasize those elements in the book to sort of change the narrative or correct the narrative or to bring in a perspective that, that I wasn't seeing covered in sort of the mainstream media coverage of this issue or even in scholarship.
Now, the title of your book, Sexagon, this might need a little unpacking, and you're kind of already pointing to it with what you've been kind of talking about as your general area of interest. But what do you mean this word to mean for your readers, and how does it kind of lay out some of the central arguments of the book for you?
Okay, so traditionally France has been referred to as a hexagon because of its shape. And because my thesis has to do with the idea that France's national borders are being defined in terms of sexuality, I came up with this pun, namely of the sexagon, that, you know, this is a sexualized hexagon and its borders are defined by sexuality. And so the way that I describe that in the book is, so each chapter is a little bit different. I cover basically five different fields. The first being activist discourse of anti-sexism activists and anti-discrimination activists who work in the French banlieue or multi-ethnic suburbs. The second is psychoanalytical discourse. There's a lot of psychoanalysts who have weighed in on the immigration debate and immigration's impact on what is considered to be sort of the delicate relationship between the sexes in France that has been put in place over a long period of time, a very slow and delicate process. And they have a lot to say about this because, you know, psychoanalysts study the connections between sexuality and culture in a very detailed way. The third field is literature. So I studied the way inter-ethnic relationships are depicted in literature, and more specifically, a certain literary trope of the difficult Arab boy, or the Arab boy who goes from being a kind of servile assistant in sex tourism literature or literary tourism literature with a kind of sexual component, to a different status in contemporary France, which is one that is kind of vengeful or angry or resentful. And this becomes the trope of the difficult Arab boy that I kind of unpack in that chapter. The fourth chapter looks at cinema as a kind of, as a form of surveillance. So I look at how cinema kind of pries into the intimate lives of immigrants and minorities, because those worlds and their lives are seen as sort of resistant to penetration, and how cinema as a kind of tool can pry into these worlds, sometimes just to expose, but also other times with a kind of sensitivity which restores a certain intimacy of their private life. So it's sort of a double-edged sword in my analysis. And the fifth chapter, which probably landed me in the most hot water with committee members and so on, was on pornography. And I just found pornography to be like a fascinating and understudied cultural document that really reflects and distills in the purest possible way all the anxieties and fears that are stoked up in the immigration debate. And not only does it reflect them, but it kind of addresses them in a very honest and direct way, notwithstanding all the other, you know, the dark side of this industry, which is about, you know, various kinds of exploitation and exaggerations also of people's fears. So basically, these kind of five fields, what I'm trying to argue is that the cultural arena, so cultural actors, writers, journalists, activists, psychoanalysts, filmmakers, pornography producers, they have also participated in making and building this alignment between proper Frenchness and proper views on sexuality. And this sort of proper Frenchness, this proper sexualized Frenchness, has been articulated in counterpoint to sort of Muslim and Arab diaspora understandings of sexuality. But what I'm talking about here, of course, is the assumed Muslim Arab attitudes and not necessarily their actual practice. And also, I should state that most of the time in the book, I'm only dealing with representations and not actual, I'm not doing sociology, I'm not doing ethnography, even if I study those things as kind of rhetorical fields or types of discourse.
Now, one thread that kind of runs through the book is this notion of virility. So can you kind of unpack that term for us? What do you mean by that? How does this notion of virility serve your project for your subjects that you're looking at?
Yeah. So I think it's interesting. It's an interesting moment because a couple of other scholars, one of them being Todd Shepherd, has also paid a lot of attention to this term. And I saw it kind of coming up a lot in maybe not the term itself, but what the term refers to. I saw it coming up a lot in my research, which was mainly done between, I would say, like 2008 and 2000, maybe 12, 13. And what I was noticing was that virility for me was not just about men. It had to do with other kinds of character traits and conditions and statuses. So what I mean by that is, for instance, like I can take something like the phenomenon of girl gangs in the French milieu and study how, for instance, women who wear hip hop attire, who might wear baggy clothes or athletic gear and speak in a certain assertive way, or with a deep voice or using slang, might be perceived as having sacrificed their femininity, or even might be perceived as lesbian when there's a slippage from a kind of quote unquote masculine gender expression to lesbianism, right? A lot of female rappers have dealt with these sort of aspersions of lesbianism just because of their gender expression. And what I was trying to say is that in these neighborhoods, in the cultural productions I was looking at, masculinity, and I'm using virility a little bit differently from masculinity. So I wanted to sort of redefine virility in the work that I was doing, because virility normally is derived from, you know, the Latin root vir, which refers to men. But what I was trying to say is that virility can be produced not just by men, but also women. Women can participate in what virility means when we're talking about les femmes viriles, or virile women, in terms of these girl gangs, or in terms of just women who have a kind of athletic hip-hop demeanor. And that for me, virility, the expression of virility, ended up having less to do with sexuality or gender expression, and more to do with neighborhood belonging, or expressing certain kinds of urban attachments, and also expressing the fact that one comes from France's visible minorities as a children, are children of immigrants, are part of the diaspora. And so that meant that both men and women who belong to those classes could have a very similar sort of language, very similar codes. And it's those codes that I'm calling virile, and not necessarily their gender expression. And I'm saying that code is more primordial than what we normally refer to when we talk about virility, because we see that even those sort of candidates for ideal assimilation in France, namely, you know, women and homosexuals. And I should sort of go into a parenthesis here and say that because the banlieue, or the French multi-ethnic suburbs, are seen as inhospitable or sexually intolerant, inhospitable to sexual minorities and women, and sexually intolerant, there's a lot of sort of rhetoric about helping women who come from these areas, and especially helping young gays and lesbians who are invited to sort of flee that area as sexual refugees and find safety in the city center. So I noticed in the research that I was doing that, you know, banlieue sexual minorities and banlieue women held on to these codes, these manners of speaking, these manners of dressing, which I'm calling virile codes. And that showed that virility was something that was less a trait that had to do with sex or gender, and more to do with, you know, location and class and religion and minority experience. So that's how I would kind of explain my perhaps non-traditional use of the word virility. And so, for instance, to talk about girl gangs and how girl gangs allow us to see how virility is constructed and mastered and performed, kind of in a way that reminds me of Jack Halberstam's work on female masculinity, allows us to see, you know, once we can see virility outside the traditional male body, we can see how it is constructed. And if I can just add on something, Muslim women actually who wear the veil have been characterized as masculine in certain feminist discourses, I would say more mainstream feminist discourses, because the veil, interestingly, is seen as a kind of armor and as a kind of combative appendage. And so, you know, Fadila Amara, for instance, who used to be part of this, or who was one of the founders of the group Ni Pute Ni Soumise, the translation in English is Neither Sluts Nor Doormats, which was an activist group that was advocating for women's rights in the banlieue. So she termed Muslim women, and especially educated Muslim women going to university, she called them the soldiers of green fascism. And so it was just interesting to me how, like, the veil, kind of, which might be considered in maybe non-French context as a sort of, it could accentuate femininity, it could be an enhancement of femininity or used to express femininity, in this context is seen as either censoring femininity or as being in itself masculine, and that Islam itself, if, you know, veiled women and Muslim men kind of with beards, both of them would be seen as masculine, and thus the religion as a whole kind of appears more masculine if veiled women appear that way also.
Now, one of the other kind of major threads that's throughout the book, and you pick it up in different ways, is this kind of tension between ethnic sexuality and French identity, in a sense, through kind of this notion of homosexual clandestinity that you talk about. So how does that play out for your subjects in these representations, and how would you say that these queer identities disrupt kind of national narratives about sexuality?
The story of kind of clandestinity actually starts not in the terrain of gender and sexuality and queer studies, but actually in the terrain of quote unquote illegal immigration or undocumented immigration. And clandestinité, or clandestinity in my usage, refers to sort of the condition of being or living underground or shying away from scrutiny. It could refer to sort of underground economies. And the kind of parallel that I wanted to make between that clandestinity and sexual clandestinity is that I believed, or I was trying to argue, that sexual subcultures also act in this clandestine mode. So for instance, you know, the North African diaspora in France has sexual, I would say, sexual minority subcultures. They're quite vibrant. There are clubs and nightclubs dedicated to it. There's online communities that I talk about in my book that are dedicated to it. But they prioritize what they call discretion, or not sticking out, not being ostentatious, not necessarily requiring that everyone be, quote unquote, out of the closet or wearing one's sexuality on one's sleeve. And the values kind of total transparency, and especially sexual confessionalism kind of revealing every intimate detail about one's life as a sort of value akin to honesty or integrity. That is something that is sort of interrogated by these minority sexual subcultures that I was looking at. And so what I was trying to suggest was that it's the fact of living under scrutiny as immigrants and children of immigrants that causes these gay and lesbian North Africans, Franco-North Africans, to resort to sexual clandestinity. And this is in contrast to the idea that North African and Franco-North African gays and lesbians in France are just importing something from their parents' countries of origin, meaning that they're importing the idea that homosexuality has to remain secret. And that is something that comes from outside France. It's not French. It's something that should be condemned, or we should encourage these populations to abandon that attitude. But what I was trying to say was that actually this kind of closetedness, or return to the closet, even in some cases, of people who regret being out or have found outness lacking in some way, this sort of attraction to clandestinity, to sexual clandestinity, I'm suggesting is actually the result of living in modern France and has nothing to do with, or very little to do with, the cultures of origin of the parents. And the fact of being kind of an ethnic minority under scrutiny causes the sexual minorities living within that minority to reconsider radical transparency as a kind of assimilative move, and as something that just sort of delivers their minds and bodies to a kind of surveillance state in a way that they don't like, or that they don't want to participate in. So for me, I kind of look at that as a reconsideration of what ethnic sexual minorities are doing as less something to do with regression or backwardness and more to do with resisting a modern surveillance state and the way it's reflected even within sort of the in gay mainstream culture.
Now, the first chapter, you talked about some of the things you do in the first chapter already, but here you look at journalists and activists and how they address or portray Muslim minorities when thinking about sexual diversity in France. Can you talk a little bit more about this? Perhaps you could talk about this report, Homo Ghetto, that you look at. What do these how does this report frame homosexuality in their characterization of ethnic minorities? And then the other part that you do in this chapter that was really interesting was you kind of look at how gay interest publications kind of a response in a way. So what's kind of the two sides of this event, if we can think of it in that way?
So this book, Homo Ghetto, was kind of an important intervention by a journalist named Franck Chaumont. And Franck Chaumont used to work at an Arab interest radio station. And he had hosted a program about attitudes on homosexuality in the banlieue that he found quite shocking. So he decided to do a full-on investigative report. And he anonymously interviewed a group of gays and lesbians and not just North African, but also white. I believe he interviewed a trans person as well, who live or work in the banlieue. And I was paying particular attention in my book to the first portrait. And the title of that portrait is Majid Rakai est gay, and that means Majid thug and faggot, or thug and the pejorative word for homosexual. And the "and" in the thug and faggot subtitle is italicized. So there's a suggestion that one cannot be both sort of the stereotype of the banlieue, thuggish guy with a lot of swagger, and a proud homosexual without there being some kind of contradiction or even comic effect. And so what I found interesting about this portrait was that he was, normally an interview, like a sort of ethnographic interview, is done in a kind of subtle way to sort of, there's all this work to kind of familiarize yourself and get the interview subject to trust you so that they're comfortable sharing information. And what I found interesting about this interview was that it started on extremely hostile terms with the interviewer kind of seeing Majid as a schizophrenic kind of hypocrite, someone who leads a double life, someone who may be, very proud of who they are, but is ashamed of being an out homosexual, like of admitting his homosexuality to his peer group, to his banlieue or North African peer group. And kind of ignoring a lot of the, what I thought was, interesting behaviors and, ways of negotiating sexuality and or sexual attachments and religious and cultural attachments. And so just to be more specific, so Franck Chaumont would say things like, this guy is living in sexual misery. He doesn't associate with white people. He is a prostitute, a sex worker. He is living a schizophrenic attitude in regards to his religion. And I found that actually this guy, Majid, the anonymous, that's his anonymous name, his anonymized name, was doing a lot of interesting things in terms of his answers and his life decisions and the way he's, what kind of groups he socialized with. And specifically, he was sort of, I felt that Fonctionnement was kind of ignoring everything queer or non-homonormative that Majid was doing. So what I mean by that is, like, you know, if the proper way of being gay, the homonormative way of being gay, is to be out, is to live in the city center, is to, you know, have just one monogamous partner, and to not do sex work, then Majid is failing at being gay, right? But if you take a different perspective and you see that Majid, for instance, is developing very interesting contacts with other men who have sex with men in similar situations in the banlieue, and is doing all of that online or in cruising grounds, or is actually having an entire kind of gay private life while simultaneously being part of a gang and being part of a religious community and being part of a kind of traditional, you know, a run-of-the-mill traditional sort of North African community, that is a very sort of interesting negotiation of many communities, and that Majid actually has his foot in many more communities and can pass through many more communities than someone like Fonctionnement, his interviewer, can. So I found a kind of queerness in that sort of radical passing or having one foot in so many different communities and keeping yourself together at the same time and not choosing between a religious and a sexual identity, right? And I also found that, you know, Majid was really interrogating this whole idea that one has to leave the banlieue in order to live a fulfilled life. And granted, you know, he did talk about hardships, certain hardships that he had to live through living in the banlieue. But he also talked about sort of the happiness of being in a kind of large homosocial group in his gang, for instance. And the fact that even though all his gang mates were ostensibly heterosexual, there was a certain high homoerotic charge and certain sexual things did happen, albeit not in a kind of sort of vanilla monogamous way, right? And so I was kind of trying to tease out all of these details that the journalist Fonctionnement had missed in his portrayal. And my larger point actually in that chapter was to explain how strange it is that someone who professes to be, you know, a friend of the gay community who is himself gay, Fonctionnement, would subject another person to this kind of hyper-aggressive, hostile, almost psychoanalysis that gay people in the, you know, early 20th century had to go through themselves, albeit, you know, facing a very skeptical medical community psychological, you know, a community of psychologists who are trying to demonize and pathologize homosexuality. And so I show kind of ways in which Fonctionnement is actually repeating all the same steps that were used to, you know, demonize and pathologize homosexuals in the early 20th century, and how, you know, how strange that is. And how much it is kind of redolent of or evocative of a false consciousness, or the idea that you know, Majid may say that he is happy or fulfilled, or that he's satisfied in his sex life, but Fonctionnement, who has a higher understanding of what is properly gay or homonormative, or what is the proper way to be gay, that he can analyze him transparently and say that this person fails crucially at being gay, and that we need to really combat this whole sort of virilist strain that can be seen among certain types of banlieue gay men, that they're holding on to something which belongs more to the banlieue than to sort of the gay community in the city center they should aspire to be a part of.
That leads well into your second chapter, which looks at the role of psychoanalysis and how psychoanalysts, psychiatrists understand sexuality's relationship with culture and politics in many ways. What's going on here? Where does this type of thinking come from in the frame of psychoanalysis, and how would you say it affects Muslim and ethnic minorities?
Well, I think where this interest in psychoanalysis started was that I kept noticing that French psychoanalytical writers and thinkers were being invited to comment on Islam in newspapers and op-eds. It started with kind of an interest in the work of Malik Shebel, the late Malik Shebel, but also people like Fethi Ben Salama. And, you know, non-North African psychoanalysts as well, who sort of took a very hostile view to immigration's effect on sort of sexual conventions and the symbolic order in France, or that the idea was that the mass influx of people with sort of different relationships to, you know, to patriarchy or to a mother's role in the family, or a son's relationship to his father, or a daughter's relationship to their parents, like that these things could totally destabilize sort of all the work that has been done to sort of, you know, properly, or just to, it could destabilize and throw off kind of the compass of how we understand sort of the French national psyche in a way, but more particularly, the relationship between the sexes. So, I started realizing that a lot of the work that was going into kind of demonizing or doing the character assassinations of, Muslim subjects, Arab subjects in France, was happening via the psychoanalytical community. And I don't mean to say that this is representative of the French norm, but this is much more kind of conservative strain, I would say. Like, one of the people I study is Michel Schneider. What I was finding out was that this was a very effective means of demonization. And the sort of trope that I explore in this chapter is it's kind of an image. It's an image of a broken family. So I look at three figures. I look at the impotent father, or the father who has lost his job and can't provide. The next figure is the veiled sister or mother. And the last figure is the turbulent adolescent, usually male, but can be female too. And all of these figures are interesting targets of psychoanalysis, and interesting books have been written about these figures in different ways. And they complete each other, right? So because the immigrant father who has become injured at his job, or who did not succeed in his immigration project and can't make enough money and can't restore his own force and power over his family, which is crucial in psychoanalysis because of, you know, the Oedipus complex and the fact that the son and the father are in a relationship of tension, right? So what's perverse about this Muslim family is that the power has moved from the father to the son. And it's the sons who are these unruly, turbulent, angry, aggressive kids that can basically replace their fathers, supplant their fathers, and they are making the law in the suburbs, for instance. This is in the rhetoric that I'm kind of being critical of, right? And so then you have someone like, the position of the veiled woman is interesting. Number one, as a mother, because the mother is seen not to sort of stand up for her own interests as a woman, but rather to enable the son in his patriarchal violence or his patriarchal aggression in order to advance her own interests or her family's interests, right? So kind of mothers in this context are not seen as sort of forces for, I would say, like women's rights or, standing up for women's interests, but rather as enablers of patriarchy and friends of patriarchy. And this kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier with sort of the masculinization even of Muslim women. And so all of these forces kind of feed off of each other and create this dysfunctional family unit that I was kind of comparing and contrasting with what we consider to be sort of like the bourgeois family unit of Freudian psychoanalysis, the two parents and the kids, and kind of the all the case studies that we hear about that involve that kind of arrangement, but rather to switch it to this family. And I say that this is a broken family, but it's very much one that has been constructed. So I talk about how it's constructed in the media and how its dysfunction is actually the end product of this long process of demonization all the work that goes into presenting this family as non-functional, even though it might be something, this family arrangement is more so the product of you could look at, for instance, the catalyst of this dysfunction in this family as being the injury to or the defeat of the father, which comes through not being able to have a successful immigration project or being able to sort of, he wasn't able to guarantee that the generation after him could improve upon the accomplishments of the generation prior, right? So in a way, it kind of mirrors what I was talking about before, which is to view the problem not as a menace coming from the outside from North Africa, but rather a problem that starts within France and because of certain pressures on immigrants within France.
Now, you mentioned earlier this literary trope of the Arab boy, kind of gave us a little kind of snippet of what that's about. Can you tell us a little bit more? Where do we find this trope? What kind of models of virility or masculinity does it kind of present us? And what consequences does it shape?
This trope, for me, the thread kind of starts with the literature I was talking about in regard to my, the undergrad thesis that I was doing on literary tourism in North Africa, the likes of André Gide, elsewhere Oscar Wilde, and many other French writers, and more recently, Jean Genet, in the Spanish context, Juan Goytisolo, for instance. All of them have had interesting interactions with both positive and negative with young Arab men. I could talk about Paul Bowles and his collaborations with, I use the word collaborations in quotes because there's a lot of controversy about that, but Paul Bowles' collaborations with Mohamed Mrabit, Mohamed Shukri also, and the Beat Generation, for instance, which spoke very vividly and maybe in a kind of raw way about the attraction to North Africa being one, that is inspired by drugs, but also the possibilities of alternative sexuality. Allen Ginsberg, for instance, and Tahar Ben-Jaloun talks about that in his interactions with Allen Ginsberg. So what I was noticing was a kind of evolution of the trope going from the trope of the Arab boy, going from a figure that is sort of young, servile, at your service, ready to, please a visitor, ready to accept financial favors or other kinds of favors, and really just sort of a feature of the background and a kind of secondary character that will aid in the European voyager's process of self-discovery, and sexual self-discovery and self-actualization too. André Gide, for instance, goes to North Africa and regains his health, but also develops accepts the idea there and kindles a kind of desire for men in North Africa. So it's sort of almost like the kind of influence of the region and climate on his personal transformation, which he takes back to France. So I was noticing that, you know, and I traced this thread through the era of colonization through decolonization to today, where we see echoes of this relationship with the Arab boy, but also a kind of disappointment that the relationship to the Arab boy or Arab young man has changed. So as early as a book like as early as Roland Barthes' Incident, which is a collection of sort of vignettes about his time in North Africa and his interactions with North African young men, you see a kind of change taking place where the Arab boy goes from being servile to being difficult, to questioning sort of the wisdom of the European sage, to frustrating the desires for knowledge, whether bodily or intellectual, of the European visitor. And then in diaspora, in metropolitan France, the relationship between, you know, especially older white French men, whether in the literary intelligentsia or not, and young Arab men has been very fraught. And, you know, I looked at Frédéric Mitterrand's book, La Mauvaise Vie, or The Bad Life, where he talks about sort of disappointing or even traumatic encounters with Arab men in sort of cruising areas or saunas, where he really makes a distinction between kind of his way of having a fulfilled sexuality and the fact that, you know, the Arab men that he interacts with are kind of violent, sexual, macho types who do not care about the pleasure of the European partner, right? Which is ironic when you look at, when you take a really, when you step back and take a larger historical look at this, because, you know, the pleasures of the Arab partners were never considered in sort of the previous arrangements of the ones that feature the servile Arab boy. And Joseph Boone, who came out with a book recently called The Homoerotics of Orientalism, he studies that very closely, this kind of the disproportion and the power imbalances in sex tourism narratives or the literary voyages of that have a sexual character, that the literature devoted to that. So I was kind of studying this trope to show how, you know, this idea of a difficult or resistant or frustrating Arab boy who just doesn't give themselves up as easily as they should. This has a long history, and I want to connect that history to the previous history of sort of sexual availability of Arab boys that was part and parcel of kind of power imbalances that had to do with colonial power and colonial arrangements.
An excellent chapter you have looks at the cinematic representations of ethnic sexualities. And here you're doing a lot. But what's happening in some of the filmmakers you're looking at? How do sympathetic filmmakers portray Franco-Arab sexuality and virility? How do they navigate these public-private interactions within their own subjectivity? What kinds of spaces can these types of sexual expression take place? What are you trying to do in this chapter?
So I think, like, in that chapter on cinema, I'm trying to show how cinema can be a double-edged sword. So cinema can be used to sort of expose and embarrass immigrants and minorities in regard to their sex lives, which may be, you know, not properly homosexual, not properly heterosexual. And that there's a certain glee kind of in, especially in documentaries, in exposing the secret lives of immigrants and minorities. And I think, like, this is maybe a little bit disconnected, but we saw a version of that with, you know, the fact that, for instance, the Nice terrorist, Mohamed Bouhlel, was also on gay dating apps and was, you know, his phone contained, you know, pictures of his both male and female sexual conquests. And there was this kind of glee in exposing the private life of this perpetrator. There's many other instances that I can cite, but you know, you just have to go to a French bookstore like the FNAC to see how many books are available that expose you know, the truth about Arab and Muslim sexuality. Leila Slimani, who won France's top literary prize, just came out with a book exposing sort of the problems, the very problematic attitudes towards sexuality among Arabs. Kamel Daoud, who wrote I think the English title is Meursault, an Investigation, or I think the title in French is Meursault contre-enquête. And anyway, so he, you know, came out with an op-ed in the New York Times talking about the sexual misery of the Arab world. And there's just kind of a demand for this kind of speech of exposure and taking the veil off in regards to sexuality in the Muslim world. Okay, so that was just a lot of context for what I want to say next, is that cinema could continue in that vein. But I also found that certain filmmakers were interested instead not in exposing, but actually in visually depicting secret or comfortable or intimate spaces, spaces that are suggested to be outside of public space. So what I mean by that is, like, for instance, you take a film like André Téchiné's Les Témoins, or The Witnesses, that's the English title, and he will show you cruising areas that are under cover of darkness, that are in parks. He will show you what happens indoors as opposed to outdoors. He has a love story that takes place within an RV away from the public, between a police officer and his gay lover, an Arab police officer and his gay lover. And, you know, you see how the police officer, for instance, will say one thing in public and another thing in private when he's with his lover. You see in a movie like Christophe Honoré's L'Homme au Bain, or Man at Bath, that the banlieue, far from being a place where, you know, homosexuals have to hide, could actually be a place where homosexuals can cruise to find partners, or where men who have sex with men in the banlieue can easily find partners because it's such a homosocial environment, and the possibility of a homoerotic encounter is embedded in any kind of encounter that you can have with between two men who are just minding their business in the banlieue. And so that kind of shifts the terrain from the idea that you have to go to a specific designated neighborhood in the city center, what we would call a gayborhood or the Marais, in order to find opportunity or satisfaction, romantic or sexual, and that you do not have to visit a designated space. The space is all around you in which that kind of opportunity to present itself. Perhaps not in the same transparent way, or maybe the opportunities are not as easily had, but the whole space is a space of possibility in that sense. And I also wanted to study, so another film that I mention is Sébastien Lifshitz, it's called Wild Side. And it's a really interesting film about a love triangle between a trans French white woman, a banlieue Franco-Arab guy who is a sex worker and has sex with men and women, and a Russian refugee, perhaps immigrant, refugee/immigrant, who originally is in a relationship with a trans woman character, but also develops love and a sexual bond with the Franco-Arab part of the love triangle. And they're all extremely, well, you know, they find kind of through living together and through living on sort of the margins of Paris and living together in these undergrounds, which are both sexual and economic, that they really have a lot in common. and that they also have to live in secret, but the space that they share together is a secret clandestine underground space, which provides them comfort and which provides an alternative family, right? So I think like those are just some of the films that I talk about and the way they kind of redefine the idea of like private versus public and where one's, you know, sex life and where one's kind of consciousness about one's sexual orientation or one's sexual practice takes place. I think all these three films kind of force us to reconsider sort of the magnetic draw of like the gay city center or the city center as just a privileged space where, you know, what do you call it? Public displays of sexuality or affection can happen. And so I just found that like cinema was a really interesting tool to depict what intimacy looks like on screen without necessarily exposing it. And then how tricky that is and how subtle the filmmakers have to be to both talk about something which is secret without exposing it to a harsh light.
Now, your last chapter focuses on pornography, which in your work basically captures these exaggerated sexual projections in the most clearest ways, really. What role does pornography play in the sexualization of ethnic bodies?
Well, like I said before, it's the most kind of undistilled reflection of anxieties and fears about immigration and about ethnic minorities. But as we know from psychoanalysis, you know, fears and desires are very much connected. And just as sort of like you can almost you can imagine a kind of graph which would show that the more alarm there is about insécurité or lack of security and even terrorism, the more interest there is in sort of the what I'm calling the young Arab homo thug, or you know, very masculine, aggressive banlieue character, and the you know, the veiled woman who must go through a striptease to be sexually liberated, mostly by a white male partner, who might show her her way to orgasm. And, you know, explain to her what sexual pleasure is, right? So I think that, so I made a distinction actually in the chapter between gay pornography and straight pornography, because I found that while, of course, there's exploitation on both sides and there's distortion and exaggeration on both sides, there are some studios on the gay side of things that actually play with sort of fears generated by the political and media establishment in an interesting way. And the studio that I'm talking about is Cité Beurre. And Cité means like housing projects, and Beurre means Arab. And their sort of scenarios are so kind of exaggerated to the point of being comical, but in a kind of tongue-in-cheek, self-conscious way. So they'll have scenarios of like young banlieue guys, you know, ganging up on policemen and getting a kind of sexual revenge, or kidnapping young bourgeois twinks, young men, you know, very effeminate, hairless young men, and holding them for ransom. Or, you know, getting back at breaking into an apartment of two, you know, upwardly mobile gay guys. And what's interesting in the films is that, so I make a contrast, like I said, between gay pornography and straight pornography, because in the gay pornography, you see sort of these men as kind of being like enfant terrible, or, you know, not docile, not assimilated young men who are playing with the power of the taboo and generating erotic interest based on the taboo and sort of turning the tables of power and getting a kind of sexual revenge over those who have power in French society. But in the straight pornography, you see, you know, mostly it's it's either veiled women who are being forcibly unveiled, or there's the trope of the berette, and the berette is the female bow or female arrow. And so berette, just an aside here, if you do a Google search and you type in berette, you'll get pages and pages of pornographic results before you get anything that just speaks to the condition of being, you know, a young Arab woman in France. And so the other trope besides the veiled woman who must be forcibly unveiled is the trope of the desperate berette, or the a kind of poor, thuggish woman who is in dire economic straits and will do anything to get some money, and who is hard on her luck and who can be paid to do things that are kind of degrading. Right. So there's quite a few studios who have banked on that kind of trope. And there was a whole issue actually in Tel Quel, which is a Moroccan Francophone magazine about Arabs and the X-rated film industry, which was really a really interesting special issue that goes into more detail and interviews some of the porn stars. But anyway, I found this contrast actually between gay and straight pornography, because so in the gay pornography, actually, you see men who are fully clothed, who are wearing, you know, balaclavas or masks. They don't have to reveal their identity. What's more important is sort of the sexual act and the fact that they're kind of reduced actually to their genitals, basically, kind of the way that we see similar things happening with black men in straight porn in the United States. And sort of reduced to this kind of abject, just ethnic symbol that is anonymous and interchangeable, right? And what's so different about that is that in the straight pornography, what's so different about the straight pornography is that you see women, what's important about the women is that they be made nude, and that sort of their state of mind or emotional state be visible on their faces. So it's just very interesting sort of about like what needs to be exposed, what can be hidden in terms of the pornographic imaginary. But what I also found was that pornography doesn't just, I'm talking about the gay pornography now, doesn't just stoke fear. It also sort of uses sex and sexual tension and sexual release as a way to kind of process those fears and to have a less kind of terrified attitude about the other, because sexual pleasure can be generated from this meeting of adversaries, and that one can get over, or one can process one's the tensions that exist in French society in a sexual way.
Now, you wrap up the book kind of thinking about our contemporary moment, in this kind of broader context of refugees across Europe and other kind of events happening. In what ways do you see the continued sexual demonization of Muslims within this kind of contemporary moment? How do you think your book can kind of help us think about what's happening in France and Europe more broadly today?
Well, this is a very tricky issue because it's always difficult to talk about the now. But I think, so I'll say a couple of things. So I think the biggest example for why it's important to think about sexual demonization of immigrants and minorities is what's been happening now with the refugee crisis. And for instance, with the backlash after the events in Cologne, Germany. So there was a New Year's Eve a couple of years ago where there were allegations that roving hordes of young men of migrant background were sexually harassing and sexually assaulting women. And, you know, there were quite a few cases documented by police. At the same time, it wasn't necessarily Syrian refugees who were committing this violence, and only a very few, a very small number of people were actually sent to court or prison for prosecution over these crimes. But nevertheless, the public opinion basically there was a sea change in public opinion almost from one day to the next, where sort of Angela Merkel's policy of welcoming Syrian refugees especially became suddenly unpopular. And it was really the events in Cologne that kind of triggered this. And there's some articles on Jedalia that explain what happened better than I can, and I can refer you to them or your audience. But basically, it just was amazing to me how much opinions could change based on this incident. And so we saw things like campaigns to, have sort of sensitization materials placed in sort of the materials that are destined for new arrivals to Germany, for instance. There was also public discussion about swimming pools and whether, these Syrian refugees and other refugees could be expected to behave in a mixed gender environment. And of course, there were incidents where people did not behave, and sort of the media extrapolated from that. And I think that this is becoming this whole idea of like the sexual menace of especially of the sexual menace of large young groups of men is something that we've seen in all kinds of xenophobic materials. But the far right is really capitalizing on that today. And you see it in a lot of their rhetoric that, the far right has all of a sudden become friend to women and homosexuals because they see this terrain as being a kind of prime recruiting ground for new followers, because this idea of the sexual menace is so believable and people will really believe it to be true, even though it is part of sensational, you can't divorce it from sensational newscasts. And the other thing I would say is that, to revisit again the profile of the Nice attacker and even one of the Paris attackers, Salah Abdeslam, there were witnesses who said that he had been seen in gay clubs in Belgium, I believe. And then Mohamed Bouhlel had a whole other, he had a very, active bisexual life. And that, so what I was kind of interested in that story is the idea that homosexuality, for instance, used to be seen as something that was kind of incompatible with radicalization or incompatible with the path to terrorism. But now very much people have kind of ceased, I would say certain people have ceased to see, homosexuals or Arab homosexuals as necessarily a kind of privileged group for assimilation that is maybe perhaps more ready for assimilation or more docile or less willing to go down the path of radicalization. But I think with sort of the age of cell phones, and this is something that we also saw with Omar Mateen, the attacker in the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting, who also had a gay life that he hid, but also didn't hide. That it's the age of cell phones, which are making people realize that this whole concept of having a bisexual double life or a public-private distinction is kind of getting worn thin with the more sophisticated tools that we have for surveillance. And so I think that what I've been kind of noticing and what I'd like to write about more is the way that this sort of this hyper scrutiny that and these very sophisticated tools we have for prying into people's private lives on their cell phones, what that will reveal sort of about these assumptions that we have about how gay people are mostly secular or mostly, are not going to be tempted by radicalism and are so different from the mainstream in their communities that they would be sort of ideal targets for rescue or assimilation. So I think I'll just leave it there for that answer.
Yeah, no, Muhammad, it's a wonderful book, and I do think you're right that there's lots of extensions of the project that that I hope you and others will take up. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the things you're working on now, or things that you plan to have coming down the line?
Yeah, so I'm just now getting started on a second book project, and the tentative title is Eurabia: Reverse Crusades and Counter-Colonization in European Dystopian Literature. And so what I'm looking at there is sort of all of the kind of fear-mongering rhetoric and fear-mongering fiction about what will happen to Europe if politicians don't act on curtailing immigration, and sort of the demographic dystopian projections that are made as a result of that. So some of your listeners might be familiar with Michel Houellebecq's book Submission, which kind of imagines France, like a subdued France under a Muslim president. There's quite a few other works that deal with this. And there's also nonfiction works that talk about, you know, there's a book called The French Suicide, which is written by Éric Zemmour. And basically, the sort of the gendering that I was talking about of France gendered as female and Islam and Arabs gendered as male kind of continues in this work, in the sense that sort of left-wing, centrist, accommodationist politicians are seen as sort of weak, you know, less than men, kind of like incomplete men who cannot face up to immigration and these hordes of aggressive masculine men who are arriving, you know, by the boatloads into France, and that it requires a kind of rekindling of older forms of European masculinity for us to face this threat and to actually stand up to it. So it's kind of a whole stoking of the chauvinist element in kind of nationalist politics that is being called for now by the far right and even by the right in sort of more subtle forms. But for instance, this book, The French Suicide, talks about how there's this sort of like perverse desire on the French left and the French center to accommodate immigration and to sort of, you know, take it take it lying down. And what I'm interested kind of in is in this sort of rekindling of French national masculinity, white French national masculinity, and more specifically Christian masculinity. So you see in a lot of like far right rhetoric, rehabilitations of figures like Charles Martel or Charles the Hammer. Charles the Hammer was a warrior basically who repelled the Muslim invaders as they were coming up the Iberian Peninsula. And, you know, the Muslim invaders were making raids on France at that time, but were never really able to occupy it. Some debate whether they even wanted to occupy it. But Charles Martel repelled the Muslim Arab invaders at Poitiers, also known as the Battle of Tours. And so he is rehabilitated as a kind of person, a mythological figure who guaranteed the Christian future and destiny of Europe. And that if not for him, Europe might look very different. And Europe might look like what will happen if we do nothing to curtail immigration and these Arab and black men, basically African immigration, takes over Europe. So I'm interested in sort of this alarmist visions of the future. It's almost like not science fiction, but anticipatory fiction of what might happen demographically to Europe if politicians don't stand up to immigrants. But I also want to look at sort of, for instance, how the Battle of Poitiers or the Battle of Tours was depicted in French school textbooks. And imagine also like what it might have been like to deal, for instance, with a classroom in the French banlieues where you have basically a majority of black and Arab kids who are reading this history lesson, a history lesson which is also done in the same year as the discussion of slavery and the origins of slavery actually in the Arab slave trade, as opposed to talking about the European slave trade, which came later. So Those are sort of two chapters that I tentatively have right now, and I'm still working on it, still generating more ideas. But I'm probably going to dedicate the next couple of years to this project.
Great, Mohammed. Yeah, good luck with that. That sounds like another fascinating project, and I'm sure you will do it justice in your analysis. So, thanks again for making the time to talk about this wonderful book.
Thanks for having me.
That was my conversation with Mohammed Amadeus Mack about Sexagon, Muslims, France, and the Sexualization of National Culture, published with Fordham University Press in 2017. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.